This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia, the podcast where we visit with authors about information located beyond the pages of a book. And today, that author is Amor Towles. His first book, Rules of Civility, was a novel layered in the opulence of society. The theme is repeated in his second novel, A Gentleman in Moscow, but this time it turns to Russia during its transition to the Stalinist era. After the Russian Revolution, Count Alexander Rostov, the gentleman of the title, is placed under house arrest at the Hotel Metropole, and for the next three decades must decide whether he will master his circumstances or be mastered by them. A Gentleman in Moscow takes place primarily at the Hotel Metropole, where the gentleman of the title, Count Rostov, has been sentenced to indefinite house arrest. And he remains under house arrest for more than three decades. In fact, the novel spans 32 years. And early in the book, the Count recalls his godfather, the Grand Duke, telling him, "If man does not master his circumstances, he will be mastered by them." Is that really what keeps him buoyed? I mean, because from the sentencing scene on, he was just charming.
Yeah, well, I guess it's, you know, to some degree a personality defect of his. But I think some of the, you're right to point to the advice that he gets from his godfather as kind of a starting point of the Count trying to grapple with his circumstance. He finds himself not simply under house arrest in Moscow in 1922, but under house arrest at a time where virtually everything that he has valued as a growing up in Russia is systematically being destroyed purposefully by the Bolsheviks. Obviously the class system, but a way of elegance, freedoms of travel, a cultural heritage is all being kind of unwound by the Bolsheviks with the interest of launching a new approach to society. So in that circumstance, I think the Count is faced with how do you go on from there? You know, do you give up? Do you fold? Do you fight? But there's many different options, and he's got to start to navigate how he is going to survive, thrive in that environment. I think that the we as Americans have a pretty narrow view of Russia in the Stalinist era. We have learned that period, you know, from the end of the revolution to the beginning of the Cold War in Russia was really defined by hardship. You can point to the bread lines and the general lack of goods to sort of a heavy-handed government who's keeping an eye on art and expression and eliminating religion too. The purges, that come ultimately, the imprisonments, the people being afraid of speaking out loud. Well, all this is true. I mean, this is an aspect of a very important aspect of Russian life during those decades. But as I say, we have a pretty narrow view of life in Russia at the time, in that that's the only thing we think of when we think of Russia during that period. When in fact, of course, the vast majority of Russians during that time continued to live their lives. They continued to have birthdays, to fall in love, to get married, to have children and be proud of their children and hope for the best for their children, to gather as families and celebrate in some way, whether it's a family, whether it's a holiday or a religious, quietly celebrating a religious anniversary of some kind. So life went on. And I like to think of it as, you know, if you had a family that would gather around a giant banquet table annually, to be together, and the government came in and began removing one luxury after another. You know, the caviar is gone, and then the champagne is gone, and then, you know, the lamb is gone. And eventually you just get down to bread and water and salt. The family would still gather around that table to celebrate that anniversary, and they would still find much to celebrate amongst themselves. I mean, their relationships, the intergenerational relationships, their, you know, the laughter, the memories. So even, yes, in these decades of hardship, there is a will to joy that in human life. And so a part of this book is the Count under tight constraints, slowly determining and figuring out, both personally, based on advice he'd been given by his grandmother or the Grand Duke, but also by the new people he meets and by watching how they live, so discovering how to thrive and be happy in these new set of circumstances.
Now, you mentioned like the churches being raised and things like that. Why was the hotel spared?
That's sort of an interesting bit of factual history. The hotel is a real hotel. It was opened in 1905, and it was, at the time, the greatest hotel in Russia. And it was very much a sibling of the grand hotels that were being built throughout Europe and in the United States in that decade. The Plaza Hotel in New York, the Palace in San Francisco, the Ritz in Paris, Claridge's in London, these were all built within about 10 years of each other. And they were relatively similar, in many cases taking up close to a city block. They were hotels with multiple restaurants, with palm courts, you know, serving tea, with American bars, with music and dancing at night, with billiard rooms and card rooms and reading rooms and shops. You know, they really were sort of small cities and in a very grand fashion. And this hotel was certainly of that class. And when the revolution ended and the Civil War finally ended in 1922, the Bolsheviks moved the government from St. Petersburg, where it had been for hundreds of years, back to Moscow. But the Kremlin was in no condition to receive a modern government. It just didn't have the facilities. So the Bolsheviks seized the three best hotels in the city, including the Metropole, and turned them into their offices. They lived in them. They had meetings there. They had administrative offices, typing pools, you name it. That's what the hotels were being used for. But then shortly after the Civil War, the major European capitals recognized the Bolshevik government as the official government of Russia. It took America more than a decade to come around to that. But the European capitals immediately really recognized the Bolsheviks as the authentic and authoritative leadership in the country. And as a result, the ambassadors of the European capitals began showing up in Moscow, as did the representatives of commerce, you know, who were interested in reestablishing trade or making new relationships to the new government for the purposes of sales and purchases, et cetera. And the Bolsheviks realized that with these figures arriving from London and Paris and Vienna and Milan, that if they forced them to stay in sort of proletariat hotels, that those visitors would think that the revolution was failing. So they kicked all of the party people, the apparatchiks, back out of the Metropole, and they restored its pre-war elegance. They redressed the doorman in, you know, sort of quasi-military uniform, just like the guy in front of the Plaza Hotel in New York. Caviar and champagne were served once again in the dining room. American jazz could be heard and danced to in the hotel. So they restored the elegance for the benefit of the foreigners who were coming to the country. And as I say, this happened almost very quickly after the end of the Civil War. And a weird sort of side effect of this was that this became known kind of throughout, certainly Moscow, but St. Petersburg, throughout Russia, that in a time of hardship for Russians, that these amazing sort of foods could be eaten, you know, liquors could be drunk, music could be heard inside the walls of the hotel. And the Metropole kind of became a little bit like Oz for the Russians. It became something you would dream one day, I hope to dine in the Metropole, or, you know, if I'm lucky, someone's going to take me there. And if I'm a young woman, I want to date a Westerner so that he will take me to that hotel. And you see the hotel appear in Russian literature throughout the early 20th century in that, just that way, as just like the Plaza Hotel in New York can be imagined by people across America as this, you know, sort of center of elegance and fun, you know, that's the way the Metropole was viewed.
Now, you painted such a vivid image of the Metropole. How much behind-the-scenes research or access were you allowed?
I think one of the great ironies of our time is that we have come to demand more factual accuracy from our novelists than we demand from our presidential candidates. You know what I mean? So, you know, the presidential candidate gets to say whatever they want, you know, and if a novelist gets an address wrong, you know, he gets a thousand emails. And, but so I'm not a historian. I don't speak Russian. I didn't study Russia in school. I am a lover of Russian literature. I'm a lover of Russian culture, and I use that as my foundation to invent the book. The book is an invention. Now, that said, I had seen the hotel in 1998, and when I came up with the idea for the story, it immediately popped up as sort of a perfect setting. But I didn't know the hotel intimately, and so I kind of invented the hotel kind of from my imagination. But then when I was about two-thirds of the way through the first draft, I went back to Moscow, and I spent a week at the hotel. And that was great fun, you know, just to be there, figuring out what I'd gotten totally wrong, what I'd gotten right, you know, what I might change, what I might not change relative to history. And one of the sort of the fun aspects of that trip was that the staff knew what I was up to. And so for you know, one thing, the suite I was in was the suite that the Bolsheviks wrote the first communist Russian constitution in after the Civil War. The head of the party locked the constitutional committee in this particular suite and said, you can't come out until you're done. You know, that's where I stayed, and you can, with the Bolshoi ballet sort of right through the window across the square. That was, you know, it's kind of great fun. But they also, you know, they had shown me some of the famous suites, and I said, well, you know, can I see the kitchens and things like that? And they said, oh my, you know, really, do you want to see that? And I said, well, yeah, I'd love to see the, you know, what's behind the veil. And so they took me down into the basement, and the kitchen is almost is the wrong word, because it is an incredible warren of maybe, you know, 20 different rooms, which is where they prepared food for the guests of the Metropole in the heyday. And this was partly, as the hotel staff, you know, explained to me, is a vestige of the shortages that they experienced in the early 20th century. Because of the shortages, the hotel basically had to be willing to make anything that it wanted to serve, you know, from scratch. So it had its own bakeries, its own pastry, you know, chefs, its own, it had its own butcheries. It had a room dedicated to cleaning fish with a drain in the floor, a room where they stored pheasants and, you know, a cooler that they stored pheasants, and a room to defeather them and prepare them. So kind of you had room after room after room with all these various raw materials and all these specialties of cuisine, all before you even got to the room with the ovens. And as I say, that was kind of a vestige of the time. It was fun to see.
Now, I'm fascinated by your use of measurement, specifically time, space, and importance. For example, regarding the structure of the book, I believe I read in the publisher-provided Q&A that you described it as an accordion structure.
Yeah, that's right.
And so the beginning chapters, they advance by a doubling principle?
Well, all of them, yeah. Well, okay. Yeah. So, I mean, you're absolutely right. The way the book is structured is that it begins with the counts being sentenced to house arrest, and he's marched through the doors of the hotel. And then the book tells you what happens one day later, 2 days later, 5 days later, 10 days later, 3 weeks later, 6 weeks later, 3 months later, 6 months later, a year later to the day, and then 2 years later, 4 years later, 8 years later, 16 years later to the day. And then it works back in the other direction. So from that midpoint in 1938, you learn what happened 8 years after that to the day, then 4 years, then 2 years, then 1 year, 6 months, 3 months, and so on, right down to the last 10 days, 5 days, 2 days, 1 day, until the final page. And so it's kind of got this odd symmetry. Now, I know that sounds like a weird thing for an author to do. My hope would be that, first of all, that people who read the book do not even notice it. It seems that it never even occurs to them that the book is structured in this kind of mathematical, symmetrical way. But I do think that readers will be aware and sense and satisfied with the structure, in that when the count goes into the hotel under house arrest, you kind of want to learn day by day kind of what those initial impressions are. But you wouldn't want to hear those day by day impressions for 30 years, right? And nor would that be very natural in human life. What starts to happen is, after you've kind of experienced something, it seems so granular, as you get accustomed to it and you begin to change the way you live, life does kind of move in greater leaps and bounds. You know, I think about my own life here in New York. My first year here, my first two years here when I was 25, there's a huge inventory of very specific memories from that period as I met new people, you know, went into new jobs, lived in new apartments, found restaurants, fell in love, all those various things. But then you kind of get this phase where I pick a job and suddenly 5 years go by that you've spent in that job and with those colleagues, and they kind of blend together. Then you get married and you have kids, and 10 years go by, you know, where that 10 years is really defined by so much of your activity and your memories are around the rearing of your children in the early stages. So life can, as you say, I'm very interested in measurement. You can experience life in these moments where every little image is sharp and clear and in your memory, but you can also experience periods of time where it blends together as a phase. And the book is kind of structured in a way as a representation of that.
And also, I think you said that the novel's geometry takes the shape of a diamond on its side. So in the beginning, you introduce us to so many different aspects that are tightened later and narrowed as the book moves along to the second half.
Yeah, and that's a big, I actually think that's probably the biggest challenge I gave myself in writing the book, or the biggest obstacle I posed, is this diamond type shape. Is as you say, the first 200 pages, you meet a lot of people, you see a lot of rooms, you learn about individual objects or memories, you hear conversations, and many of those play very significant roles in the back half of the book, and so. The challenge is to make sure that while you're reading that first 200 pages, it doesn't feel like something's being built around you, or that stuff is being introduced without purpose. That the book feels like it doesn't know where it's going. You know, the challenge is to make all those little elements feel perfectly situated for the reader in the early stages, but then give them the pleasure of seeing those elements come back to fulfill a different purpose. And that's going to be up to the reader to see whether that works.
Well, and I also liked it in the text you used a different measurement. You were able to break down the count's remaining time with Sophia by comparing it to the way Achilles would break down a 20-yard dash. And I loved this, and I'm quoting, "But in order to advance a yard, the hero must first advance 18 inches. And in order to advance 18 inches, he must first advance 9. But to advance 9, he must first advance 4.5, and so on. And thus, on his way to completing the 20-yard dash, Achilles must traverse an infinite number of lengths, which, by definition, would take an infinite amount of time." And I just, that took on a whole, it gave me a new perspective on working with time. Oh, and then I was just remembering the clock that would strike at 12 and midnight. And was it the Grand Duke who said, you know, when that first bell strikes at noon, most of your work should be done for the day? And that was another way, a different way to look at time.
Yep.
Okay.
I had to add to that because you did such a good job of describing it.
Sorry. there are like three aspects of the book that have me wondering about your background versus the Count's. Like, first is the music. The Count said he never played a musical instrument in his life, yet he could identify the key of the bed strings as G sharp, and he gave an upward sloping whistle in G major. And he had such an appreciation for the masters. What is your musical background?
I also do not play an instrument, I do not have as sophisticated an ear as the Count has. But I'm a lover of music, and in my first novel, Rules of Civility, jazz plays a very significant presence in that book. Both in terms of what the characters go to hear and how it's almost sort of the soundtrack that's behind the narrative and the transition that jazz goes through around the time that book is set in the late 30s, as you're moving from the swing bands to kind of the smaller groups that, you know, ultimately like Miles Davis was heading, the quartets and quintets in the smoky rooms. So that is a big part of that book, and I'm a big jazz fan for sure. Classical music, you know, what we call classical music, is a much bigger force here. Tchaikovsky, being a major component of the book, and the Nutcracker in particular. And of course, it kind of fits with the Count. He's a 19th century figure. He loves the great novels of the 19th century. He appreciates the great composers of the 19th and 18th centuries. He's the kind of guy who would go to, you know, the New Yorker would go to Carnegie Hall, one night a week, and years later could recognize, can certainly differentiate from a piece by Mozart and a piece by, by Beethoven, but even go further and recognize who the piano, you know, player is in this particular version of, you know, a Mozart piece, and how it's, you know, whether it's played with more brightness or more sorrow, you know, that he is certainly a person like that. As I say, I'm a lover of that music, of that era of music as well, but I certainly don't have the sophistication that he has.
And what is your background with wine appreciation?
Yeah, well, I like, see, once again, I'm not as sophisticated as the Count, but boy, I do like to drink it. So, yeah, I cannot tell you, you know, in a blind taste test whether a Bordeaux from a Burgundy, but the Count can. So, I mean, part of the fun, of course, of writing is that you can instill a character with some powers that you do not have. Now, of course, you have to balance that, and the Count has many failings, many foibles. Routinely will come to the wrong assumption and is bested by all the women in his life, including, you know, 5-year-old girls, 9-year-old girls, you know, in variety of contests. So on the one hand, he has these skills that are the skills of refinement that, you know, a 19th century aristocrat would probably have, or many of them would have. But on the other hand, he's not a superhero. He is absolutely can be undermined by a willful, bright 8-year-old kid.
And finally, literature. I mean, what is your background in? I mean, you were throwing characters out there at, like, I mean, it was a who's who.
Yeah. Well, that's something I do know about. So I may not be able to identify a bottle of wine or perfectly the, you know, who's playing the piano in a recording of Mozart. But although I am fans of wine and music, you know, literature is something I do know about. I've written since I was a kid. I've read since I was a kid. I think for a lot of writers, those are tied pursuits. They're not separate. So I began writing and reading seriously in second grade, and I've never stopped. And I've, you know, at this point in my life, I'm going back and reading much more closely authors that I admired as a younger person. I'm in the last 5 years, I went back and obviously partly because of this project, I reread the novels of Dostoevsky. I reread the novels of Tolstoy. I read the work of Chekhov, of Gogol, partly because I read with three friends, and we meet monthly to read classics, and we like to work on the basis of themes, and so we kind of did that together. And part of the reason we got in that project is the great works of Russian literature have all been translated anew in the course of the last 2 decades by an extraordinary team, husband and wife, Pervier and Volkonsky. And all the books I mentioned have been retranslated by them, and their translations are amazing. So it's a real pleasure to go back and read those books. So yes, I mean, I'm a lover of literature. I live with novels and with poetry, and, you know, so it inevitably it's going to express itself to some degree in my writing.
Now, your writing is very rich in detail. You describe an envelope handed to the Count as being addressed with his full name, and this is where I'm quoting, written in an indifferently groomed, relatively reclusive, occasionally argumentative script. What is your writing and revision process?
The best way I could say it is, first of all, I outline very carefully. So I don't start writing the novel proper, page one, until I've spent probably a year outlining the work, or even more. I've probably spent years thinking about it. This book, I originally thought of the idea in 2009, and I added to the outline steadily between 2009 and 2013 when I began writing the book. So I had sort of 3 or 4 years of thinking about it in the back of my mind and sketching out elements and detailing chapters and characters, conversations, themes, images. So I start with a lot of work, sort of a foundation to stand on. But so then when I write, I try to really write the first draft pretty straight through, you know, I mean, over the course of, say, a year to a year and a half. And I try to do it for myself. So I try to give myself as much liberty as possible, which is to follow my instincts and my fascinations and, you know, even, you know, to be overly maudlin in some cases, overly, you know, hammy in other cases, whatever. All my weaknesses should be on display. I take risks. I do things that I think are in just solely for the basis of being interesting. Full liberty. But once that's done, I will tend to go back and revise word for word from the beginning three times. I did that in the case of Rules of Civility. I did that in the case of A Gentleman in Moscow. I really went back to page one and revised word for word from beginning to end. And that's a process I really don't do simply for myself. I really like to think of that as I do that for the reader, you know, in that having the liberty to fill that first draft with all kinds of whimsy and et cetera, I feel like it's my part of the covenant between the author and the reader is that I will go back and try to remove, you know, the redundant passages, the cliches, you know, the self-involved passages, you know, things that please me but, you know, are not really very interesting, unnecessary obscurities, you know, all these kinds of elements that are inevitably a part of the drafting process but don't really serve the interests of the reader. And what I want to do is get down to the finest elements of that first draft, you know, the real spirit of it, the poetry of it, and as clean and sharp a version of that as possible. And so, and that is a very painstaking process. As I say, that takes years more than the initial drafting, and is just ultimately becomes almost a form of drudgery, because, you know, you've read the chapter 50 times, and yet you're going through it one more time to kind of figure out, is this really put well? Is this necessary? Is that boring? Is that, you know, or if it's boring, is it boring for a good reason, you know? And that is very painstaking work.
Were the chapter titles determined after the manuscript was complete?
No, well, some in some cases, but I kind of am crafting those as I go for the most part.
And they all are A's.
They all begin with a letter A, that's right.
As does the name of the book and your name.
Yeah.
I didn't. Why A?
That was one of those things. My instinct was it should be that way. Partly, I think, it's because there is this tug of war in the book between the reality of the challenges of the Stalinist era, you know, the really harsh realities. People were imprisoned. People did die. People did suffer. Freedoms were taken away or hampered, constrained. And there were many great things that the Russians achieved under Stalin, by the way, as well. And that's a part of the book, too, right? Is that at the time of the revolution, Russia was the most backward major country in Europe without question. Had the highest levels of illiteracy, the least industrialization, the least common ownership, you know, meaning almost all the land was owned by, you know, very small group of people, the aristocracy. So you really had the nobility and peasants. That was pretty much it. So that was all true at the time of the revolution. By the time Stalin died 30 years later, it was the second most powerful nation in the world, without question, with landing on the verge of landing people on the moon. And, you know, so, and the huge producer of steel and, you know, aviation and, you know, people ultimately going to, you know, they be, you know, going to the Olympics and having, you know, extraordinary composers and chess players and, you know, you could go on and on and on. So, you know, it was a very challenging time for Russia, but it was also a time of incredible advancement for the country at great cost, but a great advancement too, which is one of the reasons, by the way, that the contemporary Russians don't look back with only shame, you know, by any means, right? It's a very proud nation. It's one of the reasons they're proud of Putin. Not all the Russians hate Stalin. There's a lot of people who still view him as a heroic figure in the country because of helping the country land, you know, ultimately achieve what they view as its appropriate place on the global stage. So on the one hand, I've got that, right? On the one hand, I've got this very big historical mission. And on the other hand, as I say, I'm trying to depict the realities of just human life. What happens at dinner? How do you, you know, find joy? What do you remember? What do you miss? You know, how do you connect to a stranger? How do you enjoy a fellow, the life with a fellow person you're working with day to day? How do you enjoy your breakfast? You know, these elements that are very real. As I say, there's a tug of war between them. The big historical realities, some of which are very daunting, the will to joy and these sort of minor pleasures that are a part of life too. And I think that the titles for me, both in what the words are and the fact that they all begin A, is it's partly a signal to the reader that there is going to be some play in this story. It's not going to be a heavy-handed depiction of, you know, the worst aspects of Russian history. That's not, nor is it going to be, you know, a deep investigation of the Russian soul. You know, hopefully there's an element of that there. But it is going to be a little bit more playful. And I think early on as you read, suddenly there are slight elements of magic, you know, and maybe that's partly because of the way the Count views the world. But There are bees that seem smarter than you'd think. There's a cat, you know, who seems to be able to appear out of nowhere at the, you know, at the proper moment. And there's a tradition of this in Russian literature, certainly. You know, a lot of Americans were very familiar with techniques like that from the Latin American writers like Garcia Marquez, you know, the magical realists. But there's a fabulous aspect to a lot of Russian literature, both Gogol, you know, in the Tsarist era, and Bulgakov in Master and Margarita in the Soviet era. And so, you know, there's an element of that in the book, too. And so, as I say, the titles are kind of tied to that spirit, a little bit of sense of play and magic that occurs in the book, even though it's set in daunting times.
In an interview that I read, you were asked if any of the characters in the novel were based on real people, and you mentioned a story about a message in a bottle. Would you share that story?
Oh, yeah. Sort of an odd coincidence, but when I was just a kid, I was about 9 years old, 10 years old, something like that, I threw a message in a bottle into the Atlantic Ocean. We grew up spending the summers in Martha's Vineyard, Island, and did this near the end of the summer. We got home 2 weeks later, and there was an envelope, typewritten for me, a small envelope, from the office of the New York Times, and it turned out that one of the senior editors of the New York Times had found the bottle, and he wrote me, you know, a response, a letter. His name was Harrison Salisbury, and Salisbury, at the time, was, as they say, one of the senior editors of the Times, and had invented the op-ed page. He was based in New York at that point, but he had been the New York Times correspondent in partly in Vietnam during the Vietnam War, and before that, he had been the New York Times correspondent in Moscow in the aftermath of the Second World War. And he wrote a memoir of his time in Moscow, and a lot of it, the metropole appears often in that memoir because he lived there. You know, this is something I actually found out really after, you know, writing two-thirds of the book. I mean, I knew he had been in Russia. I had not read his memoir. But then he kind of goes and talks about the hotel at some length, and you know, he's there at the beginning, at the end of the 40s, the beginning of the 50s, and you know, his room is bugged, and you know, he's hanging out with all the American correspondents in the bar of the Metropole all night, and so he makes a cameo in the book. He does show up. There's a couple of elements from his memoir that kind of appear, but he as a person is in the hotel, and his hat and a raincoat play a central role in the final pages of the book, which is, yes, is a sort of a tip of the hat for me to this gentleman who I corresponded with from the age of 10 to 18 and then eventually met when I was 18.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
And my pleasure. I look forward to hopefully I'll see you in Wichita.
I hope so. That was Amor Towles, author of A Gentleman in Moscow, which was published by Viking. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover new episodes at kmuw.org or through iTunes. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our editor is Luann Stevens. Our engineer is John Cyphers. And I am the producer. This is Marginalia. And for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.